And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday, December 2nd. 26 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. Blue skies, sunshine. Also reported in the Heber Valley, currently 24 degrees. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Wasatch back. Yeah, we've got pretty quiet weather. Unfortunately, I'm sure we want some fresh snow. Not much in the forecast, though, for right now this week. It's pretty quiet with high pressure staying in control. Mainly sunny skies expected to continue throughout your day today with highs in the mid-40s. We're going to climb a little bit tomorrow to the upper 40s after overnight lows are in the upper 20s. So with high pressure staying in place throughout this week, plan on kind of a wash, rinse, and repeat weather pattern across the state. So northern Utah, still looking at least for the Wasatch back, mid-40s to continue Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, even into the weekend. We should see a little more cloud cover as a weak system brushes by Thursday night into Friday. Might help clean out some of the air quality for areas like Heber, where we're expecting some haze to build in the valley, and for also along the Wasatch front. So no big changes until maybe Sunday. Storms are popping up for next week, starting sometime Sunday into Monday, so plan on increasing cloud cover, some breezy winds on Sunday. Of course, we'll kind of fine-tune that as we get closer, but so far it looks like we should see some decent snowfall next week. Heber looking at upper 40s today, overnight lows in the teens throughout much of this week, into the low 50s tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday, back in the upper 40s on Friday with that weak system brushing by. Should see temperatures near 50 degrees over the weekend with overnight lows still near 20 degrees or so, and then partly cloudy skies on Sunday, slight chance of showers so far late Sunday, and more likely into next week.
Okay, hoping so. Thank you.
You bet.
And on the phone now from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, we welcome back Trent. Good morning, Trent.
Hey, good morning, Leslie and everyone listening. excuse me there. So, yeah, under some clear skies, the mountain temperatures are, you know, inverted. So meaning 20 degrees down low, 32 degrees up at ridgetop there. The wind has veered from the northwest to the northeast and blows 5 to 15 miles per hour across those upper elevations. Today, plenty of sunshine, clear skies. Temperatures will rise into the 30s and low 40s at about 8,500 feet. And that wind will continue out of the northeast at speeds of 5 to 15 miles per hour. One important thing to note, just along the Park City Ridgeline up there, Park City Mountain Resort will be conducting explosive work, and it's closed its boundaries today. So, you know, if you're up on the ridgeline or adjacent to PCMR, please respect their closures as they'll be working. It looks like they'll be in the Jupiter area today is what I've been told. So last week we had a lot of avalanche activity on the 26th, 27th, and 28th of November. All these avalanches failed because we had weak snow at the base of our snowpack, and then we got a storm on top of it. The last reported avalanche came from the Park City Ridgeline in South Monitor. you know, that's really been a hot spot, and I think a lot of the reason why is just we saw a little bit more wind out of the storm, perhaps along the Park City Ridgeline, and it just formed a bit stiffer slab on top of that weak layer, and as a result, we've seen a lot of avalanches across that Park City Ridgeline. Really, our number one concern today will remain this persistent weak layer. And that's going to be on those mid and upper elevation slopes facing northwest through east. And really what that means is the shady side of the compass. And here you're going to find where the snowpack structure is poor. We have stronger snow over weaker snow. And anytime we have that, it's the perfect recipe for slab avalanches. So, you know, in summary, the avalanche danger is moderate on mid and upper elevation slopes facing northwest through east. And in that terrain, human-triggered avalanches failing on a persistent weak layer 1 to 2 feet deep and up to 100 feet wide are possible. And then, like I said, the most suspect slopes seem to be the ones that were loaded by the wind from a few days ago. That's where we're seeing, you know, humans triggering these avalanches. As always, the best and safest riding conditions will be in wind and sun-sheltered terrain under 30 degrees and slope steepness. Here you can avoid the avalanche danger by being on a slope less than 30 degrees. And just as important, you can find soft snow. And honestly, the south or the low angle slopes are riding really well right now because you're not hitting the bottom or like rocks and tree and debris. It's still pretty shallow out there.
Okay, Trent, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be checking in with outgoing State Representative Brian King, taking a look back at his legislative tenure and run for governor and what's next. Heber City Manager Matt Brower previewing tomorrow's City Council meeting. Renee Hall and Jenny Floor with details on the upcoming Park City Troublemakers holiday concert. And Rick Bruff and Destiny Gross with details on the lost gems of the Sundance film series. That starts tonight. We're taking a look at some local news now. Deer Valley is open for the first time on Thanksgiving weekend. KPCW's Christine Weller has more about that.
While Deer Valley typically opens the first Saturday of December, Resort Director of Communications Emily Summers said this year everything aligned perfectly for an early opening day.
Mother Nature really cooperated with these really consistent cold temperatures, really perfect for our snowmaking system. And the way Thanksgiving fell, just kind of everything aligned for us to open for the holiday weekend.
Deer Valley opened with 11 trails and 6 lifts. Season pass holders got to ski Friday, and all guests were welcomed Saturday. Scott Strasberg and Burke Weir were excited to be there Saturday and hyped up the crowd waiting to get on the chairlift. Weir was decked out with skate skis, plastic bling, a rainbow stuffed elephant, and a conical hat plastered with stickers from various resorts. He said he was happy to add a Deer Valley sticker to his collection.
Yeah, they usually don't give out stickers because you can buy them. But they gave us one today, right when we walked in.
Strasberg wore a neon getup he called his French outfit, as it said France on the back. It's the Paris tradition to ski opening and closing days at as many resorts as possible. Strasberg said they also skied at Snow Basin and Snowbird on opening day this year.
We've hit a lot of openers, but we always, at all the openers, we always talk about Deer Valley. We just want to go to Deer Valley.
The pair also closed out the 2023-24 season at Deer Valley last spring. Three generations of the Montgomery family were also at Deer Valley Saturday. A regular on the mountain for 2 decades, Marianne Montgomery was one of the first people up the chairlift with her daughter and granddaughter.
That's the way you do it when you're a skier. You get there opening day, first hour, first in line.
Eric Brown recently got a house in Heber and is skiing at Deer Valley because it's the closest.
I'm very excited. I'm just happy to ski. We're from California. Mammoth has opened the last couple of years really early, so being out here getting to ski around Thanksgiving, super fun.
Brown also said he's excited for Deer Valley East Village in Wasatch County to open. The resort is aiming to open it for the season December 18th, a full year earlier than originally planned. Deer Valley East Village will debut 20 new runs this year and 3 new chairlifts. The new Hoodoo Express and Aurora chairlifts take skiers to beginner-friendly runs. The Keatley Express is Deer Valley's first 6-pack bubble chairlift and connects visitors to the Sultan Express chairlift on Bald Mountain. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association has launched a petition for higher wages and more benefits. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports this comes as the union continues to negotiate a contract.
Park City Mountain is open for the season, but over 200 ski patrol and mountain safety staff at the resort are working without a contract. That's because the Ski Patrol Union's contract with Vail Resorts expired in April, and though the sites have been negotiating for new terms since then, progress has stalled. On the petition's signature page, the union said its goals include base wages of $23 per hour, improved benefits, and higher pay in line with longtime ski patrollers' experience. The expired contract stipulated beginner ski patrollers earn $21 per hour. The union says that's not enough to keep pace with inflation and the cost of living in a ski town. The union's business manager has previously told KPCW its top concern is wage compression, meaning experienced patrollers' pay doesn't reflect their tenure. Posted on change.org, the petition asks for donations and support from skiers and riders. More than 1,000 people had signed as of Sunday afternoon. Park City Mountain Vice President and Chief Operating Officer Deidre Walsh told KPCW last month the resort is committed to reaching an agreement that works for everybody. Last time the Ski Patrol Union negotiated with Vail in 2022, the union voted to strike. A walkout was averted after the sides reached a deal in their 50th bargaining session. Union representatives have said a strike remains a final resort. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, after a 16-year stint in the Utah State Legislature, Brian King, a longtime representative for District 23, formerly District 28, which serves a portion of Summit County, will be stepping down. He joins me now on the phone with a look back at his year in the State House as well as what's ahead. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
You bet. Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you were elected in 2008, and in those 16 years, did the issues facing the state of Utah ever change? It seems like the big ones still are education, the economy, and the environment.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that growth and the issues associated with growth are common. That's the common theme for all those things that you just identified, Leslie, and that's a challenge for all of us. I think Summit County has certainly seen its share of those challenges in terms of housing costs. And one of the things that I love about representing a part of Summit County is Park City School District has always sort of been a leader in terms of how we handle public education, the resources that we provide to children. And it's been relatively easy given, you know, the economics up in Park City compared to a lot of other school districts. But still, that's an example leading out that I would like to see other school districts model and follow to a greater degree, a greater commitment to providing really significant, meaningful resources to how we educate our children.
Yeah, so how do you think you did for your constituents? I mean, do you think you were able to make a difference in basically a supermajority of Republicans?
Yeah, thank you for that question. There are things that you accomplish. I was able to pass dozens of bills in the legislature, and some of them were significant and meaningful in my mind. And you can make a measurement based on that, and I feel good about that. But I'll tell you, when you're in, as you say, the super minority, not the super majority, you find yourself fighting to stop some terrible bills or to keep good policy in place. And there are examples of that across the board. Sometimes, of course, being in a super minority, you don't accomplish that. We were able, for example, to not prevent the legislature from gerrymandering legislative districts both in 2011 and in 2021 with the redistricting. Thankfully, I think we'll get another chance to do that. I hope we'll get another chance to do that in light of the Utah Supreme Court decision. But we were also, one of the things that people don't really know is that we were, as Democrats, able to keep in place the alternative route to the ballot through signature gathering because the Democrats all stuck together and unanimously supported that. People don't recognize the Republicans actually, by a very slim margin, opposed that in both the House and the Senate. If it hadn't been for the Democrats uniting to favor that process, we would not have that alternative route to the ballot via gathering signatures. And I think having that alternative route, of course, benefits Utahns a great deal.
Yeah. So tell us what you consider some of the highlights of your 16-year legislative career.
Oh, I was fortunate enough. I had 8 years of those 16. I was the leader of the House Democratic Caucus. It was a real honor to have the support of my colleagues within the caucus in that particular position. I enjoyed working with the governors, Governor Herbert initially, and then, of course, Governor Cox to try to, again, advance good policy and prevent bad policy from advancing. And I appreciated the relationships that I was able to build with people up there. That's, people say, are you going to miss anything about the legislature? Sure, there are some things I'll miss. There are some things I won't miss, but some of the things I think I'll miss the most are the relationships that I've been able to have with really good quality people on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, we often hear from candidates who run for re-election that they didn't finish the job. So was there anything you wish you could have finished but weren't able to get to?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I wish we'd been more effective at providing on a statewide basis resources for education. And that ties into addressing the kind of persistence that we saw from the supermajority in saying we want tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. And the problem with that is every dollar that was cut from taxes came straight from public and higher education and the needs of children and people with disabilities. And I don't think that's what Utahns wanted. So I regret that we were not more successful on some important policy issues at persuading our colleagues to do a better job of protecting children. But I'll tell you the other thing that I feel badly about, Leslie, is I wish that we as Utahns were doing a better job of holding accountable the legislature. We saw some terrible misrepresentations and deception from the leadership of the legislature the last few months on Amendment D. And yet, in November, The people of the state of Utah just put back, in terms of numbers, the same number of Republicans and Democrats. There were no seats gained by the Democratic Party and for any of their candidates. And that was frustrating to me, because until you take bad behavior on the part of a supermajority and make them accountable for that by causing them to lose seats, they're going to be emboldened to continue to behave badly. And that's what we're going to see from this supermajority legislature, unfortunately, until we as Utahns hold them accountable.
During your stretch, we saw everything from school vouchers and book bans. We saw a strong economy despite a pandemic. We saw huge growth, and it seems like growth has been really nonstop, and yet we still don't have enough homes that people, as you mentioned, can afford to live in. So what are we missing here?
Yeah, I think what we're missing is, quite honestly, a real sense for and a commitment to the needs of working people. Regular folks who are just doing the best they can to make ends meet. Sometimes they'll have a second, even a third job. Sometimes they'll be working to keep their own families together. They'll be working to afford a mortgage and afford a car payment. And those are the needs of Utahns that I think should be prevalent on the minds of legislators to a much greater degree than they are. What we see up at the legislature and in the governor's office too often, I think, is you have very influential voices, well-heeled interest groups and individuals coming and saying, here are our desires, here are our needs, here are our wants, and cast to the side too quickly are the needs and the basic commitment that we should have to people who are just trying to make ends meet. And it's ever been thus. It's something that every legislative body across the country, both nationally and state levels, deals with, and that is, please, let's start doing a better job of focusing our priority on the needs of people who need those resources that we have to give the most. And those are working families, so, and children, and people with disabilities, and elderly people who, you know, they're people who are struggling the most to really get by in our society these days.
Yeah. Taking a look at the environment now, the National Weather Service reporting hazy skies for the rest of the week in the Heber Valley, which used to be just pristine. The results of a new study will also be released this morning from Intermountain Healthcare that shows air pollution in Utah from winter inversions and summer wildfires significantly increases inflammation in those with heart disease, raising their health risks with even more exposure. So, again, have we done good enough here?
You know, it's a great, I'm so glad you brought this up, because I've really been interested in this issue, Leslie. People don't recognize the quality of our air has steadily improved over our lifetimes, over the last 50, 60, 70 years. That's primarily because of more stringent clean air standards on tailpipe emissions from the federal government. We should be grateful for that. And we've made some progress in terms of cleaning up the air in other ways here in Utah. But here's the reality, and you just alluded to it. The more information that comes in, the more we recognize that even though our air quality is getting better, we still have these issues that deal with inversions and that deal with growth. You mentioned the Wasatch Fact. Well, the reason that there's more inversion and more issues with the air quality up there is just because of the growth of the people there, the growth of the population. So what I think we need to do is continue to work on this problem. We have accomplished a lot. We need to accomplish a lot more, because nobody wants to live in an environment that's unhealthy, you know, for your respiratory system and your circulatory system and your, I mean, there's so many ways that we're finding out poor air quality negatively affects our lives. And so we got to keep working on it.
Moving on to this year's campaign for governor. When I moved to Utah, that was when we had our last Democratic governor, Scott Matheson. So does a Democrat ever have a chance of being elected as governor again here in the state of Utah?
Oh, I think so. You know, it was a great campaign. We loved getting out and talking to people across the state. I think the pendulum is actually swinging back. It's just going to take a while. And I think one of the things that we need to focus on to a greater degree are some of these priorities that we've been talking about, environmental priorities and priorities in terms of our public education, priorities in terms of making sure that homes are affordable so that our children and grandchildren will not come to us. I mean, my concern is at some point my children or grandchildren come to me and say, hey, we'd love to live close to you, but we can't afford this. We've got to move someplace where housing is more affordable. It isn't what we want to do, but it's what we have to do. Nobody wants to hear that, and nobody wants to feel that way. So I think that, you know, there are things that we can do to work on bringing home prices down, But it is a challenge. And, of course, it's not a challenge just here in Utah. It's a challenge across the country. So we can look at what other states are doing. We can look at what the federal government is doing to address this. We've done some work here in Utah in terms of making resources available to first-time home buyers. But there's a lot more that we need to do simply because the problem is so significant. And with regard to whether a Democrat can get elected, I think Democrats are going to have to show that they're the ones who can best address these issues and persuade fellow Utahns of that fact and, you know, persuade them that what we can hope for and what we're committed to doing is looking after the economic interests of those who are struggling the most and having them come around to support Democrats.
So knowing that you would have to resign your legislative seat to run for governor, were you ready to retire that seat anyway?
Well, it was a real struggle. Ann and I wrung my hands about this back in 2023 as we approached the filing deadline about what I was going to do, and we talked about it a lot. 16 years is plenty of time to be in any elected position, and I wanted to, I think, give someone else a chance. And I also wanted to raise my voice on a statewide basis in this election that had so much at stake. And, you know, at a national level, it was such an important race in terms of Donald Trump versus at the time. We thought, of course, it was going to be Joe Biden, and then Kamala Harris came along. But I thought that there were so many things that were salient and important and that needed to be discussed that I thought, I want to throw my hat in and be able to talk about it at the, on a statewide basis at a statewide race. And I'm glad I did it. It was a interesting and fun race. It was great to get around the state of Utah, meet people, and you know, it didn't work out the way we wanted, but I think we were able to make up some ground, and I think Democrats just have to continue to demonstrate why they're a better choice for Utahns than the other side of the aisle, and I think we'll be able to do that when we say to people, monopoly on power is never a good thing. It's not a good thing economically. Monopolies hurt consumers. Monopolies in economic, or rather, monopolies in political circumstances are no better. And that's what we've got here in Utah. We've had it for decades, and we're going to do better as a state if we have better, more healthy competition between policy ideas.
So are you finished with your political career, or do you think you'll try again in 4 years?
Well, I don't. That's a great question. We're still evaluating what the next step is for Brian King. I am not of an age that I necessarily feel like I should or need to retire, but I've also served a long time, and we'll probably, you know, take some time to evaluate. But when I say we, Ann and I, will take some time to evaluate what the next step is and to what degree it involves politics. But it's been a wonderful thing, and there are people that are very warm and encouraging about, you know, supportive about saying stick around and, you know, help us in some other setting, whether it's running for governor again or running for Congress or running for other positions. We'll see. But I don't know. You know, it's also draining and time and energy consuming, even though I've loved it. There's a lot to be said for stepping away and saying you're going to pursue other interests at the same time.
Okay, well, thank you for your service in the House, and again, thank you for always accommodating KPCW. We appreciate it.
Oh, Leslie, thank you. It's been great to represent Summit County, a portion of Summit County my entire time in the legislature. I've loved that.
Okay, that's Brian King, again, state representative who retires at the end of the year. Well, the Heber City Council meets tomorrow in a work session starting at 4 o'clock, and on the phone with a meeting preview, I have City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Leslie, good morning. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. I did. First up is a presentation from Wasatch Trails Foundation. I know a lot of work building trails and connecting others was completed this year. Currently, does Wasatch County provide ongoing funding to the Trails Foundation?
Heber City does have a standing policy to dedicate 25% of all of our TAP tax revenues to trail maintenance. Mia Yu, who is executive director of the Wasatch Trails Foundation, is coming in to see if the city be willing to spend that on maintenance of soft trail surfaces, or the surfaces that you ride with your mountain bikes, rather than the surfaces that have paved or concrete. So she's coming in asking for more support using the TAP tax proceeds.
All right, so it sounds like now the foundation is looking for a dedicated budget line item for trail maintenance going forward of $65,000 a year for at least the next 2 years. Do you have that in the budget?
We do. Heber City receives currently about $600,000 annually from the TAP tax revenue source, and so we do have that.
Okay, so is the council supportive of this? I know the group's planning to make a lot of good reasons why trails benefit Heber City.
As I mentioned, the council's existing trail policy is to dedicate 25% of that cap tax revenue source to trail maintenance. So this request is specific, of course, to doing the soft trail maintenance. My council will hear this tomorrow and opine on it, see what they want to do.
Okay, because I know this year the Park City organization, Mountain Trails Foundation, helped pay for that maintenance that there wasn't funding for. So you think that the city can step up then and do that in future years?
I can tell you that through our Envision Heber 2050 initiative, which is looking at the city for the next 30 to 40 years, the feedback we got routinely from the Heber community was that trails are very important, not just the hard surface trails, but of course, the soft surface mountain biking trails. So I know Mike will take this very seriously and hear the ask and see what it is and respond to it accordingly.
All right, tomorrow council will also discuss plans for paved trails on 300 South. Is there a bigger plan for a larger paved trail network downtown?
Yeah, so the 300 South Trail is a critical link between the city's trails on the west side of town and the trails on the east side of town. We just finished building the east side of the Central Heber Trail Network 2 years ago, and now we're looking at trying to do the section on the west side. As I mentioned, this is a really important link for us because on the west side, it'll link into the Midway Trail System as well as the trail system coming up the Provo Canyon. And on the east side, it links into the Red Ledges Trails Network and the Coyote Canyon Trail Network. So we're excited about this trail section and hope to get it done fairly soon.
Midway's been discussing e-bike rules. Any plans for Heber thinking about adopting an e-bike ordinance?
My staff is monitoring what Midway has done, pretty excited about the work they have done. We'll be looking at that policy and bringing recommendations to my council for sometime in the new year.
Okay. Later on in the meeting, a public hearing and possible action to amend the Heber Valley Airport fees. So are these just revisions to existing fees or are new fees being added?
It's both revisions to existing fees and adding new fees. We have a very capital intensive undertaking at the airport. We'll be required to generate $4.4 million of new revenues to cover the capital cost. And we have to, over the next 8 years, cover about $1.8 million of that. So the fees that are being recommended on my council's agenda tomorrow is to allow us to generate not only sufficient monies to operate the airport, but sufficient monies to meet the capital needs going into the future.
So these fees that are being planned for discussion tomorrow would raise just the $1.8 million that you need?
It would cover the $1.8 million and a little bit more. I think it's going to cover about 17 to 21% additional above that. And so it will put us in a good position to cover all of our capital needs through the big picture.
All right. And who pays for these fees? It's not just the general public, right? Just those who use the airport?
Yeah, so the general fund does not provide any direct financial assistance to the airport. The airport relies heavily upon user fees as well as fiscal support from the Federal Aviation Administration. So I think that's a really important note is that the city's general fund historically has not subsidized the airport, and we hope that it will not subsidize the airport to the future. And that's why these fee increases are so important. We feel like the users of the airport should be the ones to fund the airport.
Yeah. And so what kind of, you mentioned capital intensive improvements. What are we talking about?
Well, the 800-pound gorilla is going to be relocating the runway a little bit to the south and a little bit to the west of the existing runway. That is a large project. It's going to cost many of millions of dollars. And this is to allow for the new types of aircraft that are coming into Heber Valley, that are coming in a little bit faster, sending a little bit a longer runway. And so that's probably the largest of the capital projects that we anticipate doing sometime in the next 15 years or so.
All right. Now, is air traffic at the airport growing? And if so, wouldn't that bring in more fees without having to increase them?
Traffic is growing, and we forecast it to continue to grow. We rely upon not only existing users, but new users to make sure we can fund the operations at the airport. And so the fees that we're proposing for tomorrow night are intended to not only, again, take advantage of existing users who routinely use the airport, but new users who, of course, also benefit from using the airport.
All right. Also, a council review of the development agreements for North Village Crossing and Harvest Village set for about an hour and a half discussion. This won't be approval of those agreements yet, but do you expect to see those agreements approved this year?
Likely. It's likely they may come back on our December 17th council agenda, depending how well the discussion goes tomorrow. There's still a lot to be ironed out and negotiated, so we'll see what happens tomorrow night at the council meeting. If my council feels comfortable with what's been negotiated to date, there could be a decision on the 17th. Otherwise, it could be pushed into the new year.
All right. The proposed annexation and developments are located on a 39 acres at the intersection of US 40 and River Road called North Village Crossing and Harvest Village. What's the difference between the two properties?
The Harvest Village is located between Highway 40 and Highway 32. So it's kind of that end sliver of the North Fields. And the crossing sits on the east side of Highway 40, between Highway 40 and Highway 32. So Highway 40 separates the two developments.
Okay. And in terms of density, how many units are we talking about here?
For the Harvest Village, which is located on the west side of Highway 40, they are requesting somewhere around 326 ERUs. On the crossings, which is the development on the east side of Highway 40, they're requesting somewhere in the neighborhood of 468 ERUs.
Yeah, there's lots of concerns, I know, in the Valley about cost of living and affordable housing. What's required for these two developments?
The city's standing affordable housing policy is to require a 10% density bonus dedicated to affordable housing. That is a negotiated provision in their master development agreement. And we've also negotiated those same provisions in these two master development agreements.
Now, how does the city decide where to approve more density? As you know, the council just rejected a proposal for a residential development near the new high school. Both proposals include parts of North 40. So I guess, why is it okay to develop 800 new units along North 40, but not within walking distance of a new high school?
Generally speaking, the Heber City Council has annexed areas that Wasatch County has already determined to be urban. For example, the Harvest Village development on the west side of Highway 40 was entitled by Wasatch County back in the early 2000s. And I believe the entitlements were given to the crossings shortly after that. So these two areas are already determined by Wasatch County to be urban areas. And that's why the Heber City Council is considering their annexation, is because they've already been considered urban, and we believe that it'd be benefit the community to have those taxes and those revenues that be generated off the developments coming to support Heber functions and activities.
Okay, and any concern that if this annexation is approved could interfere with the future bypass?
The bypass route is anticipated to go through the parcel of land owned by the Harvest Village investors. The Harvest Village investors have indicated they intend to reserve a 300-foot portion of their land adjacent to Highway 40 for the future bypass. The UDOT has indicated that that would be sufficient to support the bypass should it be located in that area. So I think adequate commitments have been given to the city through the MD&A to reassure the council that the bypass could be built in the area without a whole lot of reservations.
All right. Last week, the Wasatch County Council voted not to join Heber City with its Community Reinvestment Agency. This doesn't mean the deal is dead, but what's the financial impact of Wasatch County not signing on?
Had Wasatch County signed on, it would have generated over the 20-year life of the CRA about $4.4 million. And so that's the financial impact to the CRA. We intend to continue the conversation with the county, hoping to engage in a conversation that will allow them to see the significant benefits, not just to Heber City, but to Wasatch County as well.
And you were hoping to secure county support before the new year because of this new Smith's Marketplace will make a huge difference in this tax increment. So how does Smith's fit into the picture?
So Smith's was open in June or July of this year. Therefore, the new value of the $42 million investment Smith's made will hit the appraiser's books on January 1st. We were hopeful that we could have the agreement in place before January 1st, so the increment would have been redirected to the CRA agency. That would have generated, at least from the county's portion, about $45,000 a year for the agency. Not having that agreement, though, that certainly puts that at risk.
Yeah, but the school district actually is the big deal here. Have you set a date to meet with the school board yet? Again, because the taxes
are... We do not have a specific date yet. Conversations are still continuing behind the scenes. I'm optimistic that a date will be set and a vote will be had shortly.
All right. And how much money would the CRA gain if the school board joins on?
Over the 20-year life of the CRA, it would generate between $17 and $18 million for the CRA. And it's important to note that the school district would then receive not only the base, the tax base, but all new increment at the end of the life of the CRA. So if you're in this for the long game, the school district would benefit immensely from participating in this project.
Now, given that you don't have the county sign on, will the city, Heber City, have enough money to do the things it wants?
So Heber City has signed on. The portion of the increment will be generated by Heber City. A portion will also be generated by the Central Utah Water Conservancy District, who has also signed on. If we ultimately don't get the county or district school support, obviously that will slow our timeline down considerably. And so we'll just have to continue talking behind the scenes and seeing if we can't put our best foot forward and trying to serve their more noble motives to support the CRA and what we hope to do for our downtown.
Okay, Matt, anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, I want to, again, invite your listeners to Heber City's Old Fashioned Christmas, which is this Friday from 6 to 8:15. This is our traditional tree lighting. We'll have Santa, face painting, reindeer, all the things that you'd expect a Hallmark type of event to have. So I hope that your listeners will come join us from 6 to 8:15 this Friday.
Okay. Matt Brower is Heber City Manager. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.
This is Sean Railton from the Ridge Club, a proud supporter of KPCW. Getting to the mountain is easier with private seasonal lockers at the Park City Mountain base area. Double and quad lockers include boot, glove, and helmet dryers. Members can access a hot desk for midday Zoom calls, private dressing rooms, and more. Details and information at parkcitylockers.com.
Support for this program and KPCW provided by Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer, serving Utahns since 1882 in estate planning law to corporate, tax, venture capital, and startups. Now with offices in Park City. ParsonsBailey.com.
Looking for old-fashioned family fun? This holiday season, the Jordanelle State Park will have horse-drawn wagon rides through Christmas lights and lasers. Hot chocolate, s'mores, and Santa and Mrs. Claus will be there. For more information on tickets and event overview, go to RockyMountainOutfitters.com. Rocky Mountain Outfitters is a proud supporter of KPCW.
Well, Park City Troublemakers have scheduled more performances between now and Christmas, with one of them already sold out and many of them private. In the studio with details about where you can hear them, I have a couple of the singers, Renee Hall, along with Jenny Flohr. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Renee, it sounds like the majority of the concerts are private or held at, what, senior citizen centers, huh?
Yes, we have a couple of senior citizen centers. And several of these are for organizations that, of course, would you probably wouldn't want to show up for the Big Brothers, Big Sisters holiday party. But one of them, I think, was particularly fun that we are looking forward to. We've never done this before, but the Chamber of Commerce asked us to be one of the prizes for the running of the balls, and our ball was in fact picked up, and so we're going to be singing for a holiday party at a private home of the lucky winner.
Okay.
And I think that's going to be a lot of fun.
Okay. There is one public concert. When and where is that going to be happening?
That one is our community concert, which is December 15th, and that is at the Park City Community Church. And at 4 o'clock, and we do, of course, have tickets to sale available for sale. Advance purchase is $12 for adults, and you can do that by Venmo, and we have all that information on our website. You can also just pay at the door, $5 for children 12 and younger.
Okay. Do you expect it to sell out, though? Probably people need to buy tickets in advance.
Well, we always manage to get them all in. Last year, it was kind of overflowing into the foyer area, but we do manage to get everybody in for the community concert. So I would encourage anyone to come, even if they decide at the last moment to attend.
Okay. What's the website?
That is parkcitytroublemakers.org.
Okay. Jenny, who are the troublemakers? I think you're the newest, huh?
I am the newest. I replaced an alto, Linda, and I miss singing. I think the one thing I missed about high school, I realized, was singing every day in a choir. And I was involved in the Follies last year here at the Egyptian, and I met Shelley and Renee, and who were in the choir, and told me about it, and I mentioned that I love singing and missed it, singing in choirs, and so I auditioned and I joined this time. It's been great.
Okay, so auditions are required, huh?
Yes, definitely. And Jenny did a smashing job, and she's been a great addition to our organization.
It's fun. Yeah.
Well, and what you're doing in the Follies is actually you're the accompanist.
But this time I was a band organizer, yeah. Yes, and I played the piano, keyboard.
Yeah, uh-huh. And Troublemakers, there is no accompaniment.
Right, it's a cappella.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I think you get one note. Is that how it works?
Yes. Yes. And we balance it from there.
Mm-hmm. Just listen to each other. It's great. Harmony. It's all about harmony.
Yeah. Yeah. How many do you have in the group now?
There are 16. So it's basically four voices per group. So first and second soprano, first and second alto.
All right. And so when you had somebody move, then that was why you needed the replacement.
Yes, precisely, because we do, that keeps a nice balance when you have exactly the same number of people singing per part.
Yeah. And you, as a piano player, know that practice is everything. How much practicing in terms of singing needs to be done?
Well, I do a lot in my car, because I drive a lot, but also I can come up with my own harmonies as a musician, but it's been a little challenge to have to read exactly what all of the altos do together. So it's taken a little time, and of course, piano doesn't require words and lyrics, so I've had to remember which chorus we're on or which verse. But it's been really fun, a great challenge. And yeah, it's just joy. Singing is joy. I think everyone should do it. Whether you can or can't, it's do or don't.
How often do you practice?
We all get together once a week to practice together. And then additionally, we might do some other rehearsals that are maybe just within our section. Plus, all, as Jenny mentioned, all the rehearsals that we do for ourselves, actually. So I think that everyone does quite a bit of practice on their own, memorizing the music, because also that's another aspect of our performances. We're not only a cappella, but we're entirely memorized as well. So, yes, it does present several challenges, and we do have, I think it's 16 songs here that are all memorized. So,
and what are some of the selections you'll be singing?
We have, a lot of these are well-known, but maybe with a different arrangement than what you're familiar with. So, like, for instance, Up on the Housetop is not your traditional arrangement. That one was performed by Pentatonix, and I think we have another one that was also by them. 12 Days of Christmas is definitely a surprise that people won't be expecting. Oh, we have a new, this one is a real challenge, the Linus and Lucy, which is the, normally on a piano that Schroeder, was it? No, it was Linus. Was it Schroeder or Linus that played the
Schroeder.
Piano?
Schroeder.
Okay, yes. Yes, he's the one that always played the piano, and we're going to sing his piano pieces, or his notes, I guess you would say. It's a challenge, but it's going to be a lot of fun. So, we have Sleigh Ride, a blend of Holy Night, Silent Night. Jingle Bells is a very different arrangement as well. White Winter Hymnal. Oh, this one I absolutely love. That's another pentatonic arrangement, and it also has a percussion group. So our percussion group is doing something really complex and fancy, and it sounds terrific with the music. So
okay.
That one will be a lot of fun, too.
All right. The Park City Troublemakers Community Concert happening Sunday, December 15th. I think you said 5 p.m. at
4 p.m.
4 p.m. Yes. At Park City Community Church. Advance tickets are available by going online to parkcitytroublemakers.org. Best of luck to you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Well, this winter, the Kimball Junction Library presents 4 lost gems of the Sundance Film Festival. In the studio with details, I have the organizers of the series, Rick Bruff and Destiny Gross. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So, Rick, do you want to start? Just kind of tell us the genesis of this?
The genesis of Sundance, or a film festival, has been in Park City for over about 45 years, and we wanted to take a look back at some lesser known aspects of the festival's history. So we have started our first film is tonight, free screening, 6 o'clock at the Kimball Junction branch, and we're going back to 1981, when the very first film festival that appeared in Park City. It was called the Park City Film and Video Festival at that time. And there were 12 films in the independent program. We, you know, at the first festival, we also presented the first film directed by a guy named John Sayles, who was a screenwriter and novelist. And the film is Return of the Secaucus Seven, which is about a group of friends who were radicals on campus back in the day. And they are getting together again, and all the different relationships and issues between them kind of surface. And it's sort of a dramedy. It was, as I said, the first film directed by Sayles, who has became a significant independent significant presence as an independent voice, and he's been directing similar films for the following 30 to 40 years.
Okay. Yeah. So, Destiny, how did you pick these 4 gems?
You know, I think we could show a lost gem of Sundance every week for years and years and never run out of good stuff. It was quite hard to choose. Return of Secaucus 7 is interesting because it has a definite Big Chill vibe. So if you see it tonight, you may want to revisit the Big Chill. We wanted to do a documentary, so Murder Ball was definitely a choice. Something light and fun in February, that's Waitress, which is amazing. It was a film that became a musical, that became a musical film. And then we looked at Living in Oblivion for March. Interesting, Peter Dinklage, back in the day. You know, a lot of people know that he came for Station Agent, but I think he was here for, this was probably his first time at Sundance with Living in Oblivion.
Yeah, that film was 1995 and starred Steve Buscemi. It was about the trials and tribulations of a guy trying to make an independent film. And Dinklage has a small but memorable moment in that picture.
Okay. So this is a Monday night, but it looks like the rest of the film nights are scheduled once a month on the first Thursday of the month.
Yeah, it's kind of hard, you know, with the Kimball Junction Library, we're in competition for that auditorium. And so we took this Monday because we didn't want to be too deep into the holiday season. But after that, it's going to be Thursday nights at 6. It's going to be January 2nd, February 6th, and March the 6th, so early in the month. And we hope that everyone comes out. It's free.
Yeah. And we want to get people thinking about the idea of the lost gems, their lost gems of Sundance. What picture did you see at the festival that was memorable? You loved it. it stuck in your mind, but after the festival, it has disappeared into the mists of time. And you say, what the heck happened to that movie?
Yeah. So will there be some discussion either before or after the film? Is that is that the plan?
We'll definitely start with some opening comments. And then, you know, I think a lot of people are used to kind of discussion afterwards at the Kimball Junction Library. So we'll see if people are up for it. And yeah. Also, I think I'm going to put out some slips. So if you have something in mind, you can write, you know, your hidden lost gem.
Okay. Again, Four Lost Gems of the Sundance Film Festival kicking off tonight, Kimball Junction Library, 6 o'clock, and it's free. Just show up.
Absolutely.
Okay, guys, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.